Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates prominent and ordinary African women's milestone achievements in their struggles for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, racism, socioeconomic class division, and gender-based violence.
Today's show is the first program of Women's Month, and we're talking to South Africa's Minister of Science and Technology, Mrs. Naledi Pandor. Prior to her appointment as Minister of Science and Technology, she was Minister of Home Affairs in 2012, Minister of Education from 2004 to 2009, and Minister Pandor holds several degrees, including an MA in Education, an MA in Linguistics, and Diploma in Leadership and Development from the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. And she has been awarded honorary doctorates by both the Cape Peninsula University of Technology and Stellenbosch University. Welcome to the show, Minister.
Thank you very much, and a greeting to all your listeners.
It's great to have you with us. And I'd like to open today's discussion with one of my favorite quotes from Dr. Seuss, who says, "The more that you read, the more things you will know. The more that you learn, the more places you'll go." And as Minister, you have an impressive academic track record, two masters and other postgraduate qualifications. For me, you're living proof that an education is an enabler of success, and you also serve as a role model for women. What role did academics play in your life and career?
Well, I came from a family that believed very much in education. For many African people in South Africa, the route out of poverty and out of the discrimination that we experienced under colonialism and then apartheid was seen as the route of education. So in our family, our parents had the belief that the family must educate its children in order for them to have opportunity. So we were very unusual in that both the girls and the boys were encouraged to go to school, to proceed to higher education. It was the only inheritance our father told us we would have from them, that we would have education, because with it we'd be able to stand on our own. So academics meant a lot in our family. I come from a background of educationists. My grandfather was a university professor, and they really believed that the key to progress is education.
And it's interesting that growing up in that dynamic, that it was both the girls and the boys. It wasn't a case of favoring boys over the girls. And given the era that you grew up in, that was fairly unusual.
It certainly was. It was something especially my dad believed in very, very much, and he would talk about it, that it's important for the girls to have education, because otherwise they're under the thumb of someone. And so in order for them to be independent, for them to be able to direct their lives and to have control over it, they had to be given opportunity. And at times, I got the impression he thought it was even more important for girls than for boys to have such opportunity. But he always made reference to this vital need that women must be given an opportunity to be educated in order to be independent.
And that actually reminds me of a great quote by Greg Mortensen, who says, "Educate a boy and you educate an individual. Educate a girl and you educate a village."
Well, absolutely. I think once women have had the opportunity, they certainly want to ensure that it's one that all the family has, and then would have a community concern to ensure that all within a community benefit from educational opportunity. And I certainly think from our own observations in South Africa that once women have literacy, the family has literacy. But if they don't have literacy, then you're denying the family a real opportunity for empowerment. So it is vital that women and girls enjoy access, because it makes a difference.
Absolutely, and even basic levels of literacy and numeracy have shown profound effects on the well-being of women, whether it is about controlling their fertility rates, decreasing child mortality rates, improved healthcare management. I think UNESCO had indicated that an additional year of schooling equates to a 10% increase in earnings, so it helps with the succession aspects.
It just makes a tremendous difference. I truly believe in education. I began my working life as a teacher. I qualified as a teacher. That was my first degree. And I fully appreciate the value of education and the difference that it can make. So, throughout my own life, I have attempted to advance, this cause to young people, to marginalized communities, and I hope that, when something is written one day, it will be about how I actually tried to ensure that those who may not necessarily enjoy primary opportunity in a society, I attempted to ensure they have educational opportunity.
I think that's a wonderful legacy. Now, moving on to your role within the ministry and within government itself, in your position, you regularly meet with ministers and other heads of state from across the world. What changes have you witnessed since you began your political career in terms of the increased ratios of female representation within the government space and public sector?
Well, there's been, I think, quite a sea change. And we've had two women presidents on the African continent. Now we have one, sadly. There are elections this year in a number of African countries, and I'm hoping we are going to see some emergence of more women presidents. But there has been a change in the legislative sector. There are more women in parliament in most African countries. So everybody is paying attention to the gender agenda. But I'm disturbed that what we saw as a very vibrant imperative in the 90s and early 2000s has perhaps, because of early victory, somewhat gone down in terms of its urgency. And you are seeing some parliaments with fewer women representatives, and that is quite worrying. Some have maintained by legislative means a 50% representation, such as Rwanda, and we really congratulate them on that.
According to the International Parliamentary Union, they're sitting at 64%.
They actually rank among the top in the world.
The first in the world.
And then, Mozambique, I think, has really also taken steps to ensure there's a gender balance. Namibia. South Africa, it's mainly the African National Congress as a party, which I think brings the large number of women. And because it's the majority party, it then boosts the statistical profile of South Africa. But not all parties in the parliament are of a similar policy weight. I think that women activists need to be alert to the fact that the gains we have made can be reversed if we are not alert to ensuring that we maintain the equity that we had achieved in the early 90s. I am worried that some countries, women have taken their eye off the ball. Non-governmental organizations are not monitoring outcomes of elections. We have an institutionalized support to women leaders in politics. We don't have leadership academies that focus on women. Parties don't have vibrant women structures that articulate the need to pay attention to equal representation. Party constitutions don't regulate a 50-50 mandate. In the ANC, our constitution does so.
Yes, the ANC has done
both for election lists, for leadership, everything. And so you are seeing traction there. But I think we've taken our eye off the ball as a continental focus.
So in terms of your perspective, it's about women paying more attention, having the NGOs be more active in terms of the monitoring and evaluation of components, putting through greater elements in constitutions at a political level across all political parties that are represented. It seems that we've got to have aspects of a legislation component to come through. We'll be right back after this.
Hi, I'm Yvonne Chaka Chaka, the United Nations Goodwill Ambassador on Malaria in Africa. You are listening to Womanity, Women in Unity, a program against racism, socio-economic class division, and gender-based violence.
We're celebrating Women's Month in South Africa and talking to Minister Naledi Pandor, Minister of Science and Technology in South Africa. We would love to receive your comments on Twitter at WomanityTalk. Now, continuing our discussion, I see the South African government's commitment towards gender equality has been quite strong. If we look at just casting our mind back to pre-1994, there was only 3% representation. 94, 27%. 99, there was 30%, 33% in 2004, and 45% in 2009. But we witnessed a slight decline this year. What are some of the reasons that you attribute that
well,
to?
Well, in the ANC, we've got 50-50. As a party, but several parties don't have, as I said, a similar policy. So there were parties that lost seats, and women candidates were the ones who were lower on their lists, and so they've brought male candidates in. So you do need to look at the regulatory aspect. We are discussing it in South Africa today. The interesting conundrum is that our constitution provides for freedom of association while at the same time advocating equality. And so the test in terms of legislation is going to be how do these two very distinct constitutional provisions complement each other, and how might they contradict? Because a political party might very well challenge legislation on the basis of freedom of association. But I'd be keen to see which party would do that. I'm just saying, I think that there's a potential complication because there are parties that are resistant to the 50-50 notion and that have said, we prefer to drive the change ourselves. We don't want it in statute. Women are saying we want statute, some women. Draft bill that was in Parliament before the elections, and we're waiting to see whether the Minister of Women intends to revive it.
Well, I think when we start looking at examples of South Africa across the world, it's recognised in terms of the legislation that we have in favour of women and aspects of implementation. If we turn to some of the so-called developed nations, for instance in the USA, they're ranked 70th in the world in their inter-parliamentary union with representation of women at about 17%. So clearly when we have legislation in place, that's a stimulant and accelerant to get greater representation of women. Now, given that we're celebrating Women's Month, so women empowerment and equality is a pertinent point, but to eradicate gender discrimination and to strive for that equal representation, where we've got equal opportunities, equal access to resources, equal pay for work of equal value, we mentioned briefly aspects of the SADC gender protocol where they're looking at a 50-50 for women to occupy positions of decision-making across public and private sectors. And you've touched base on the Women Empowerment and Gender Equality Bill that South Africa had commenced with. What are your perspectives surrounding legislation to address these gender imbalances?
Well, I think given the difficulties that we've had with a very patriarchal society, if you don't have support of legislation, I don't think you'll see the levels of change that we need. So I support legislation, but I also support empowerment. I think it can't just be a numbers game. I would want us to have women in representative institutions, but they must have an impact when they're there. So it shouldn't just be bringing the numbers in. And this is why I am concerned about the absence of leadership development programs, training programs, because we have had instances where in some of our legislative bodies we've brought women in and they've actually been unable to execute the same obtains for men as well, because we've not trained people, we've not empowered them to play their role fully. So I do support a statutory provision in this regard, because that's the only way you'll get change. But I think accompanying it must be proper support, ensuring that people execute their mandate effectively, and that they don't feel that they're just present but don't really have a role.
So they need to have an effect.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And from a leadership point of view, do you see this as a role which government would orchestrate to set up leadership academies, or is it tapping into existing programs, whether it be someone like the Wits Business School or Gibbs offered by the University of Pretoria? Do you think these are specialised elements?
Well, women's organisations have an important role. And, you know, like the ANC Women's League should be looking to this. They should be bringing in young women, trying to teach them about Parliament, about being a public representative, encouraging them to pursue degrees in political studies, in economics, etc., so that by the time they are ready to be candidates, when they get in there, they're really impactful. And that impact, along with the skill, is an impact with a gender eye. We are impactful, but where things are sometimes missed is the gender perspective. We need to bring in that perspective in the work that we undertake as public representatives. Because sometimes we pay attention to passing legislation, passing and voting on budgets, but we're not asking about the impact on women and girls. We're not sufficiently analytical in pursuing a gender agenda.
How do you think that we can change this?
Well, as I say, it's political organizations must take this on as a duty. It's not just women, of course. Everybody should be pursuing gender equality, because it's for all of us. But it must be at the forefront of our thinking. We're doing a lot in the ANC. It's a subject of debate all the time, and when we look at advances, when we collect statistics, we disaggregate in order to see whether we are making the kind of progress we'd like to see in gender equality.
We'll be right back after this.
Hi, my name is Yvonne Chaka-Chaka, an ambassador for the Nelson Mandela Children's Hospital. You are listening to Womanity, Women in Unity, a program against racism, socio-economic class division, and gender-based violence. Womanity, Women in Unity, presented by Dr. Amalia Malka every week on this day at this time.
We're celebrating Women's Month in South Africa and talking to Minister Naledi Pandor, Minister of Science and Technology in South Africa. We would love to receive your comments on Twitter at WomanityTalk. Minister, now moving on to the next phase of the discussion, I'd like to talk about aspects from the Department of Science and Technology. And I noted that four of your core areas were about career, youth development, research, and innovation. And I recognize that with the National Development Plan 2030, there are a number of different contributing factors and articles. Mm. It's all about improving the economy of our society for greater productivity. And one of the elements which I'm quite interested in is about the education and training aspect. And there is a specific call to increase the number of PhD graduates to foster innovation and economic prosperity. And I quote from an element of the National Planning Commission, which says, The aim is to produce more than 100 doctoral graduates per million per year by 2030. South Africa currently produces 28 doctoral graduates per million per year, and if South Africa is to be a leading innovator, most of those doctorates should be in science, engineering, technology, and mathematics. Mm-hmm. And those fall directly into the jurisdiction of your department. What are your thoughts around this?
Well, I fully support the provisions of the NDP that speak to our sector. And we already have begun to develop plans to give effect to the objectives that have been outlined in the NDP. This is the mandate that we've been given by the President. But to do the things that the NDP refers to, we need increased resourcing. If we have improved resourcing, we can expand our human capital development programs and begin to produce the numbers. We have made investments in increasing the pool of master's and PhD candidates by setting up institutional mechanisms in universities and our science councils, which help us to increase the number of candidates for master's and PhD. The growth is beginning to happen through especially two models we've developed.
The one is,
the one is to set up what we call centers of competence. If there's a particular area of innovation that we've identified, we provide the group working in that domain with dedicated resources for a 10 to 15 year period to work as a center of competence, to increase their student numbers, to purchase the necessary equipment for their research work, and to have dedicated appointees that support the postgraduate students to the point where they qualify. So the centers of competence stand as very important units of research development supported by the department. The second is that we've established a funding for what we call centers of excellence, which can be virtual or physical centers. So for example, we come across a group of scientists that are doing amazing work in drugs discovery. We will again invest in them, provide them with assured research funding for a dedicated period of time, because part of the problem with producing the numbers is that a lot of the research funding is of short-term duration. So these centers of excellence, we now have 14 that we've established throughout South Africa. The third tool is a program we learnt of from our colleagues in Canada. It's a research chairs program where you create a number of research chairs in different institutions, and again you provide, you know, the appropriate funding.
Is this a Saatchi chairs?
That's right. Now, what we've done with the Saatchi chairs, we've agreed with government, these are specialized. We're going to attract the best from wherever they come from in the world, and they will have dedicated resources. They'll be able to continue with their research, but their key mandate is to produce the human resources that we require. So we have an agreement, a set profile. It's administered through the NRF. We've established 154 chairs up to this time. 128 are filled with top-class researchers, and it's very international in character, including some South African appointees.
And is this going across the spectrum of society? So it's not purely on science and technology focus, it's going across to taxation?
It's all sciences, all areas of science. It might be, there's a research chain, statistical analysis, for example. There's one in education and mathematics, a big problem for us. There's another chair in science policy, which is a very new chair established this year. There's a chair in food security, which was created recently. So they stretch across the various disciplines in science. And in 2012, we realized that, in fact, we were investing in a lot of natural sciences chairs, and so we expanded the program to include some humanities a domain. So it's a very, very exciting initiative. We're devoting significant resources. In fact, I think it's one of my bigger budget items. But it's deriving value. We've seen the PhD numbers go up by around 350%. And we've seen the women numbers go up by over 400%. So we think it's going to give us the results that we want. We also are seeing the black student numbers go up, which is very important for us. So the research chairs, the centers of excellence, the centers of competence are the tools we're using to provide dedicated resources to boost the research activity and the development of those human resources the National Development Plan referred to.
But it sounds like you've got a solid infrastructure in place to draw on that succession
plan. We hope so. We're lucky that our universities are very, very supportive and that the provision of the research chairs is of such a quality that it's actually helping us to boost research even in universities that were not very research active. So for example, we've been able to support recently two chairs at the University of Venda, a chair at the University of Fort Hare, a chair at the University of Limpopo, Zululand we're looking at for a chair. So even the universities that wouldn't necessarily be called your research intensive institutions are beginning to take an interest because of a facility such as this one.
And having those seeds populated across the country, that often stimulates greater growth.
Absolutely, and it just improves your research outcomes. The indicators are improving. The publication rate has grown substantially. And of course, the key interest is innovation. We want to see the novel outcomes being translated into a commercial product. That's very important for South Africa because we're trying to stop this import of technology. We want to develop technology and import it, export it elsewhere. As I said at a conference this week of the Pharmacological Society, the time for Africa being the customer of somebody else has now got to come to an end. We want clients from elsewhere. We no longer want to be the ones who are constantly buying. We're investing in science so that people can purchase from us rather than us constantly appealing to others.
Yes, to try to generate more of a production climate as opposed to a consumption climate.
Absolutely.
From outside.
It's vital.
The curious challenge that I've always found from an academic point of view is that often we have theoretical components, but it's that conversion to a commercial aspect. Are you working in tandem with the private sector, corporate enterprises?
Absolutely. But what we want to see is innovation from publicly funded research. But of course we work with the private sector because they're very research intensive, a number of companies, and even with them, in order to stimulate their research activity, we, in agreement with our Ministry of Finance, have developed a tax provision for a tax incentive to be claimed, that it's a very generous incentive that the corporate sector has access to. This is helping us to identify who is doing research and to encourage them to continue because they get a huge benefit. They claim around 150% of their investment.
That is a significant return.
So that is
return.
Quite a brilliant incentive. It's a new provision in our law, but it's beginning to show positive results. In fact, we're a bit overwhelmed at the moment with the claims, but it's important that we stimulate that partnership between ourselves and the private sector. But the key is there's a lot of activity in our universities, lots of activity in our science councils, but we're not moving it to that bridge between the research outcome to the product that is now commercial and on the shelf somewhere. So we've created institutional support for innovation through establishing a technology innovation agency whose mandate is to identify promise. So they would look at publicly financed research performance and say, in this space, yet there is potential for innovation. Provide the resources, help with the patenting, it's often a problem, with the cost around that, and then provide that initial support leading into the investment with the risk taker, which are your venture capital, so that we actually have a commercialized product. We're trying to bridge that chasm between the research activity and the innovative product that is in the commercial space. So given the newness of science and technology, what I'm describing to you are the steps we're taking to close the gaps that we've had in our country, because we didn't have a Department of Science and Technology before 94. But now, with many more science councils, we're supporting our universities, and we're setting up institutions like TIA, the Technology Innovation Agency, to help us bridge these gaps that we've had.
And those are great interventions, and I think they hold a lot of promise for the country.
We'll be right back after this.
Hi, my name is Yvonne Chaka-Chaka, an ambassador for the Nelson Mandela Children's Hospital. You are listening to Womanity, Women in Unity, a program against racism, socio-economic class division, and gender-based violence. Womanity, Women in Unity, presented by Dr. Amalia Malka every week on this day at this time.
We're celebrating Women's Month in South Africa and talking to Minister Naledi Pandor, Minister of Science and Technology in South Africa. We would love to receive your comments on Twitter at Womanity Talk. One of the things that I've always picked up and reflected, and it happens on a global level, that there seems to be a lack of interest with women going into science and technology fields, or the STEM subjects of science, technology, economics, and mathematics. What do you think is going to stimulate and drive more women to take up careers in the science and technology field? And does the department have an independent drive to motivate that?
Well, it will take us attracting young people at school level. That's where it's got to start. And I think part of what we've got to do is make science far more attractive to young people. We've got to provide a youth into science programs. We have a strategy in the department, and it must target girls, draw them into studying mathematics and physical science. They tend to be discouraged by society and sometimes even by our teachers.
I think there's a stereotype.
Because they're told, you know, it's hard, it's not for women, da da da, and so on. We're trying to change that. What we're doing is introducing role models of women scientists to young women while they're in school. We also do careers talks to young women about different careers in science and use women scientists as role models in science for them. And this has begun to help us to turn the corner. We run summer and winter schools with young people, boys and girls, and really try and emphasize the need for young women to be a strong part of the science community. But at the formal level, we have awards for women scientists, a specific Women in Science Awards, which works brilliantly and does help us identify those young, you know, masters and PhDs with promise. We also are working through our Science Advancement Agency, SASTA, with developing programs for schools that are dedicated and focused on young girls. So yeah, there are various interventions that we're pursuing.
The role model factor is crucially important.
We've really realized that that's important. But then once they're in science, the mentorship is important because it's not an easy domain. It is male-dominated, and it can be quite tough. There's a lot of sexism, the young women tell us. You're made to feel like you're not quite welcome. And so we have begun to work on the notion of a formal mentorship system where senior women researchers and even male researchers will be encouraged to mentor young women so that they achieve at the highest levels. of research activity.
And that adds to another dimension, because it's not only about having the technical expertise and knowledge, but it's also about navigating your environment.
Yeah, confidence
and
as well. Yeah, you need a lot of confidence in this space, because if you are intimidated, you won't, you know, really be keen to stay in it. And with science, achievement takes several years.
It's
not a sort of quick outcome area, and that's why we want to root people in science and have mentors that are dedicated to supporting their success. We have a study that's just been done by our National Advisory Council on Innovation, which is an advisory body to the minister, and they've developed a report on women in science and how we could advance gender equity. So we're studying their report and the recommendations, and we hope there'll be some useful strategies that we will implement. In SADC, South Africa's department has been supporting the establishment of a Women in Science association in the region, and we've just recently had a report as SADC ministers from the task team that's been working on this, and we've agreed that we should establish such a structure of women in science in the SADC region, and encourage them to continue.
Do you
it's
see
a very
that as
good beginning?
As being
we,
a network.
We'd like it to be a network, yeah, of women in science in the SADC region, working with there's a world organization for women in science. We want them to link up to it, so we're building them as a regional body that would be able to associate with world organization.
And with the department in South Africa, are there any specific initiatives that you work with across other countries in the continent?
Primarily, our work is with SADC, but we have partnerships throughout the continent. We have a range of agreements. We're working very well with Kenya, Tanzania. I'll be going to, I hope, Senegal soon to meet my colleague there and look at what we can do together. But there are a range of initiatives. Our biggest Africa collaboration is the Square Kilometer Array, where we're working with 8 African partner countries.
Which
that
ones?
Will have some of the dishes located there. Let me see if my memory will serve me well. Botswana, Namibia, Zambia, Mozambique, Mauritius, Madagascar, Ghana. There are 8, and each of them will have some of the satellite dishes for the Square Kilometer Array. You know, we won a greater proportion of the bid to host this most important global science
infrastructure. Fantastic achievement.
And so we are really thrilled that we're working with several African countries and are developing their human resources as well, in order to ensure that together we deliver a very successful instrument to the world. And it's been a really exciting collaboration for us. I'm really thrilled that we were awarded this important instrument to host. And I believe we're going to deliver it successfully. What it has led to is, through our scholarship program in the Square Kilometer Array, we've been able to take on students from all our African partner countries to study in South African institutions. But then the agreement is you go back to your country and work on the Square Kilometer Array program. So they are assisting us in astronomy sciences or in physics or mathematics. And we now have some of our former PhD students at Eduardo Mondlane University in Mozambique. We have a master's student working on the radio observatory we're building with the government of Ghana, in Ghana. So there's some really exciting developments that have come out of the Square Kilometer Array collaboration. And it's been our biggest, I think, science partnership on the continent. The second one is we agreed with 6 African countries that we would build a constellation, what we call an African resource, a constellation of small satellites.
Yes.
And this armed process is currently underway. As Nigeria, South Africa, Kenya, Tanzania, and Namibia. And we are now in possession of the resources of South Africa, which will help us to then get our small satellite underway. Algeria and ourselves are talking about what collaboration we need to have in order to get our joint satellite done. Nigeria is also active. So we're very thrilled that there are initiatives that unite us across the continent. The third and final one is not working as I would like it to, but now that I'm back in this ministry, it will be revived. And that is a network we had begun to establish on drugs and diagnostics innovation as an African network. What we did was, in fact, the work began before I came here, but continued when I was minister. I was Minister of Science and Technology between 2009 and 2012. And then for a period I was sent over to Home Affairs when our Home Affairs Minister became chairperson of the AU. Now I'm back in science and technology. So this ANDI, as we call it, African Network for Drugs and Diagnostics Innovation, went about the country reviewing who's working on drugs and diagnostics development for health research in South Africa and identified several research programs which are either very active, have been active, but gone down because of lack of resources. We identified 35 that have potential for excellence. And the intention was to establish ANDI as a network within the African Union to then get resources and support these 35 initiatives to complete their research and get us to the stage where we have a diagnostic tool or a drug out of the research. I was very active in that network, and we had hoped we'd get the resources and a dedicated office. It seemed to be working while I was there, and then unfortunately I was moved, and the process somewhat died down, but I'm now investigating. So I really believe it was work very well done. We'd identified several countries, Nigeria, Cameroon, Benin, South Africa, where promising research is being done on diseases that are in Africa and don't enjoy interest by other drug developers.
It's finding solutions to African problems.
That, I think we'll do well.
But those are wonderful contributions that the department is making to the continent and not just to South Africa. In closing the discussion, Minister, can I ask you to share a few words of wisdom that you can offer to women listening on the continent?
Well, I think we need to say to women on the African continent that they have been an incredible resource for the continent, and they must never forget that. Often when we talk of women in the continent, we tend to talk of them rather negative terms, as though they're not of value. But when you look at that child who is walking to school today, she's walking to school because of a woman, because it is the mothers who ensure that our children get to school. I never forget a conversation I had with one of our respected authors and activists who told me a wonderful story about how she every morning would observe school children in her township walking to school, and she'd wonder, these kids, their shirts are so clean, their shoes are polished, when was all this done? Because I know their mother works in town and comes home very late. And she says she realized the power of women through observing those children, because she knew before those women sleep, after they come home tired from their exhaustive work, some, as very domestic workers, they would make sure that their children's uniform is ready for school, that they wake up in the morning and have a little bite to eat, and that they send them off to school. And she said, just looking at those kids, she thought, the power of women is absolutely amazing. That author was Ellen Kuzwayo. I've never forgotten that story, because it's absolutely true. Many of us in Africa, if it wasn't for our mothers, we wouldn't be where we are. Even ourselves, I came from an educated family, but my dad was in politics, so he was hardly around. But our mother made sure that we always did what we needed to do in order to succeed. And that's the power of women. And I think African women need to, one, recognize their power, two, assert it for the good of the continent. Because I think, really, the good of the continent lies in the hands of the women of Africa.
Thank you, Mr. Pandor. Those are fantastic remarks to close the show on. You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance on frequency 9625 kHz on the 31-meter band. And we've been talking to Minister Naledi Pandor, who is the Minister of Science and Technology in South Africa.